Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Marie Cusick in for Scott Lamar. Today, we're talking about climate change with Dr. Richard Alley, a professor of geosciences at Penn State University. He's joining us from WPSU in State College. Dr. Alley, thank you for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you, Marie, and greetings to the good listeners of WITF.
Well, we're here to talk about a pretty alarming report issued by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change last month, which says the world has perhaps a little over a decade to abruptly shift course and drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions if we're to avoid the worst effects of climate change. So, Dr. Alley, before we get into looking into the future, could you just help everyone understand what's happened already? Climate change is already occurring. So how much warming have we already seen?
Right. So we have warmed roughly 1 degree Celsius. That's 1.8 Fahrenheit. The land warms a little more than the ocean, and we mostly live on land. So we're coming up on, you know, 2.5-3 Fahrenheit for where people live. And that is having effects. We are seeing almost all the mountain glaciers of the world are getting smaller. We're losing ice. Sea ice in the Arctic is shrinking. We're getting less snow cover in the spring. We're melting ice in permafrost. We're seeing migration of plants and animals poleward and upward. When the rain comes, there's more water in the air, and so it can rain more intensely, and that is increasing flash flooding in some places. It dries out faster, and that can make bigger fires in some places. The ocean is rising, so we're seeing impacts already.
Well, this was a special UN report examining the impacts of what 1.5 degrees Celsius warming would be like. But that's less. That's actually half a degree less than what countries agreed to in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord, right? So why were they looking at this 1.5 degree level?
Right. So as you know, there's an overarching treaty, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from Rio, that commits the world, including the U.S., to avoiding dangerous human impacts on the climate, dangerous anthropogenic influence. And so we've agreed to this, and virtually all the nations of the world signed on and said we have to stop from dangerously influencing the climate. But initially, they didn't say, this is what's dangerous. And so the scientific community has been working very hard to quantify what it means at different warmings. What does 1.5C mean? What does 2C? What does 3C mean? And then that goes to the policymakers, the government persons, the public, who decide what's acceptable. And there's increasingly been a focus on 2 Celsius as the global average warming. But a number of countries were saying, wait a minute, I'm a small island state. 2 Celsius, a lot of me is going to be underwater. I don't like that. And so you had a real push at the Paris conference for people to say, let's see if we can do a little better and save more of what we have now. And so out of Paris came this request to the science of the world through the IPCC to say, what would we benefit if we could hold it to 1.5 rather than 2?
So how serious is this? You talked about what's already happening. Some people really aren't connecting the extreme weather and the impacts we're seeing to climate change currently. But the picture they're painting looks pretty bleak. How worried should people be?
Yeah, well, it is. This is where it gets difficult because it really is impacting a lot of people now. It really is having costs. But we're still here, and we get up in the morning and we go to work. So the world hasn't ended. And the question of how much do we invest now to head off climate changes that will last for 10,000 years versus helping people right now is a difficult one. So the big picture is every degree of warming is a lot more damaging and a lot more costly than the previous degree of warming. We've had a degree so far. It hasn't cost us a whole lot. The next degree will cost a lot more than the first one did. If we go go past 2 towards 3, it will cost a lot more than the second one did. So the prices keep going up more steeply. Whenever we stopped, we just missed the worst thing, but it could get bad.
And I want to say we're talking about Celsius here, so 2 degrees Celsius is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. But these numbers feel really small. You know, when you talk to people about a few degrees of warming, or you talk about the catastrophic effects of 3 feet of global sea level rise, you know, you go to the beach and you see the sea rise like with the tide, and you move your towel back. Like, do you think part of the issue here with people understanding is that these numbers don't really hit home for us?
I'm sure it is. But when we had about 4 or 5 cooler than today, we were in an ice age, and Boston and Chicago were under ice, and central Pennsylvania was the frozen tundra, a real frozen tundra of permafrost and muskoxen and stuff. And so 4 or 5 degrees Celsius change globally averaged was enough to go from the ice age to today. It raised sea level about 400 feet. If you put this in units of ice age changes, we're going to be doing close, not quite, but almost half an ice age in going forward to 2 Celsius. And if we don't do anything by the end of the century, we might be most of an ice age. That will be a huge change for the world. And it's not the same changes as got us here from the ice age, but scaled like that, something really big, something everyone would know.
Now, the U.S. has pledged to withdraw from the Paris Accord under President Trump. He said he doesn't think it's fair to the U.S. I mean, where's the conversation among the rest of the world here? Does the United States have an obligation to do something about the problem because we've contributed so much to it historically?
I believe that most of the rest of the world would view it that way, that we're a large part of the problem. We can be a large part of the solution. We have been important in generating the international discussions that led to the agreement to work on solving the problem. And I think they look at us and really wonder what we're doing right now.
And I want to say we welcome your questions and comments about climate change with Dr. Ali here. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are @SmartTalkWITF. And again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So Dr. Ali, I wanted to talk to you about, you mentioned some of the small island nations were really pushing for this report to look at what 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming would look like. Who is climate change affects everyone. It's a global issue, but who is the severe warming going to hurt more? I mean, do we in the United States and more developed countries, do we have more resources and ability to adapt than less developed countries? What's that conversation like?
Right, absolutely. So if you have winter bulldozers and air conditioners, a little bit of warming doesn't hurt you too badly relative to the size of your economy. Winter, maybe you have one fewer blizzards in the future to close the airport. Air conditioning, you can work in the summer. Bulldozers, you can make walls when the sea rises. If you're a poor person in a hot place and you don't have winter bulldozers and air conditioners, all warming hurts you. So the winners of burning fossil fuels now are primarily wealthier people in colder places, and the losers are poor people in hot places now and everybody in the future.
When it comes to helping people in the United States understand what's going on with climate change, you know, all morning on the news we heard about the deadly wildfires in California. We've had very severe rainfall here in Pennsylvania over the summer, caused flooding. We've had powerful hurricanes. How much can we attribute the weather events that we're seeing to climate change?
Right. So We've always had weather. We'll always have weather. And climate change is making some of it worse. We actually now have a science of attribution. And reasonably rapidly after big events, you'll see scientists bubbling out, there's a human fingerprint on this, and we know about how much. There's a fascinating study, as you well know, Syria is not a happy place right now. There was a drought in the Mideast. The drought did not cause a civil war in Israel. The drought did not cause a civil war in Lebanon, but it probably was the trigger for the civil war in Syria. And we humans made that drought two or three times more likely already. And that's been done. You can look at run the models very carefully, look at alternate possibilities, and say that our warming has already increased the risk of drought in places that it then causes bad things. So our military leaders have looked at issues like this, and they say, do not blame climate change for the drought, but it made it more likely. It is a threat multiplier.
Okay, I want to go to the phones right now. We have a call from Dan in Harrisburg. Dan, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing this morning?
Doing well, thanks.
That's good. I just had a basic question as far as private citizens within the United States showing concern for climate change. Does it make a difference on the global scale, not to turn it into a political conversation, with our president denying that it exists and how we can help on a more larger scale?
Okay, were you able to hear that, Dr. Ali?
I got some of it, Dan, okay. And good morning, and nice to chat with you.
Yeah, the connection's not great, but he was asking about President Trump denying climate change and whether the U.S. is kind of sidelined from the global discussion here.
Right. So I think that, the U.S. can't solve the problem by ourselves. I don't think the problem can be solved without us. So this makes our role very important. I believe it's been very strong that every country on the planet signed on to this. And so changing that changes the discussion. I'd add something, which I think is very important. As you probably know, the Nobel Prize in Economics is a well-respected undertaking, and it was just given to an economist from Yale named William Nordhaus for using business-friendly classic economic theory to show that dealing efficiently with climate change helps the economy as well as the environment. So the Nobel Prize in Economics this year went to the demonstration that if we use our knowledge on this, we help the economy.
And a lot of people talk about the costs and what it will cost to not deal with climate change, or what it is costing us to deal with a lot of these impacts from it. But I want to talk a little bit, too, about the ethical dimensions, because the United States and other industrialized countries have historically created a lot of the problem. And in the United States, we don't often talk about our moral obligation to people around the world. But do you think that, if somebody's on a small island nation that could drown in the future and just not lose their land entirely, do we have a moral obligation as well to address this problem?
Right. I show some slides of sort of who's changing the climate and who's vulnerable to the changing climate, and it's just the negative of each other, essentially. So the people doing the most to change the climate are hurting the least. The people doing the least to change the climate are hurting the most. And if you believe in the golden rule, this is just wrong. And so I have a quote on my slides from Pope Francis, from Laudato Si, that we cannot leave this for future generations. I could quote Jimmy Carter across the board. If you really are dedicated to the golden rule and you look at who's changing the climate and who's hurting, there's a real issue here.
Okay, and we have another phone call. Andre from Carlisle, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment very quickly on the fact that the corporations are largely who I see as being responsible for climate change. Now, they seem to be the ones who are doing most of the preaching that, oh, we need to change our living standards, we need to, reduce our footprint, do everything we can as individuals. Yet, I noticed that they are very quick to move into countries countries that have lax or no environmental regulation and complicit governments or corrupt governments that look the other way when it comes to, you know, their disposal. And really, I'm almost getting tired of hearing about the issue itself because it feels like I'm being preached to by a bunch of hypocrites who they don't actually want to do anything about it, because if they did, they wouldn't be taking the actions they take. For example, you know, the move to industrialize Africa. Africa, most of the countries in the continent have a long history of corruption and being able to be bought off by anybody with the money to do so. So, you know, if they're going to say, okay, we need to stop polluting the environment, why aren't they moving into places that have tighter standards?
Okay, well, thanks for that comment, Andre. Dr. Ali, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, thank you, Andre. I think what you'll find is that there are corporations who have pushed fairly strongly not to react on this. There are corporations who have made public statements that may not look to you as if they're exactly in line with what they've done. There are corporations that are leading and who have been right out front and saying we have to do things about this. My suspicion is that there's a diversity in corporations in the same way that there's a diversity in people. They ultimately do have this task of making money, and so in some sense they're doing what we ask them, because we have retirement funds and other sorts of things that are asking them to make money. So they're part of a big conversation, and I believe that they will be good citizens as we allow them and we help them.
Well, this gets into another question I have about collective action versus individual action. You know, we have been looking to governments to solve this problem, and he mentioned corporations, whether they're solving it or not, or working to address it or not. But if you're an individual and you care about the climate, is there a lot you can do? Because you know, it sort of feels like governments have been meeting for decades to decide how to address it, and here we had this big agreement in 2015 in Paris, and we find ourselves a few years later reversing course. So, I mean, what can one person really do here, or is this just going to have to be a collective response?
No. This is very clearly, energy is in everything we do. It's so important that this very clearly will involve us as a group and us as individuals. And there's a huge amount that one can do. Probably the first point is the big thing, to vote, to talk. The Yale climate communications people survey America on what they think about climate. Most Americans think that climate is changing and it's a problem. Virtually all Americans want to look for solutions. A whole lot of people will say we should be doing research into solving this. When you frame it as an opportunity rather than as a problem, they get on board and say, let's do this. In no county in America is the average person talking to their neighbor about this. So virtually everyone is on board, we can solve it, but most people are not talking about it. And probably because it's just gotten so polarized that there are a few really loud voices. If you bring it up at the Thanksgiving table, and Uncle Ed says, oh, that's an evil lie from those people who are trying to take away my pickup truck, and you say, it's okay, Uncle Ed, just pass the gravy, and you know, and we'll talk about the game. And so the talking to your neighbor, looking at the opportunities, looking at the solutions, America is on board with solving it if we find the way to discuss it. And then individually, you can't do everything. Don't pull your hair out and sackcloth and ashes because the world is ending and you're doomed. But if you've done the big thing of voting and talking to people, think about picking something. And it might be bicycling, and it might be the solar cells, and it might be whatever. Think about picking something. And if everyone picked their something, there'd be a whole lot of things happening. We'd get over that hump into a better energy system on the other side.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. Richard Ali, a professor of geosciences at Penn State University. We've been talking about climate change and the latest report from the UN. We appreciate your time this morning.
Well, thank you, and thanks to your listeners. Take care.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Marie Cusick. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Marie Cusick, sitting in for Scott Lamar today. And we're talking to Blair Hedges, a professor of biology at Temple University. He's authored a new paper on the loss of biodiversity in Haiti that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And he has found that Haiti has lost, has less than 1% of its original forest left. And this is causing a mass extinction event because of this deforestation. So Dr. Hedges, welcome to the program.
Oh, good morning, Marie.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. But let's, before we get into your findings too much, I want to talk about what is biodiversity, and you know, why does it matter?
Yeah, that's a good question. Biodiversity would be all of the species we know on Earth, and we know about 2 million. It includes the microbes and the big animals, the mammals and the frogs and the lizards. So why is it important? Well, you know, a lot of value is intrinsic, and that is priceless. That is, we appreciate looking at animals in art, living around plants and animals. And then other value is economic. For example, the food we eat, you can put a price tag on that, and that's part of biodiversity as well. So we all kind of realize that biodiversity has a high value and we want to save it.
So you and your colleagues look specifically at what's happening in Haiti, and you said that it's really lost 99% of its primary forest. So why is there so much deforestation happening in Haiti?
It's because the people need to cook their food, and they have no, for most of the country, there is no source of energy except charcoal. So they need to make charcoal from the forest. And also they need to grow the food, so they need to clear the forest to grow the food. So it's agriculture and energy for cooking food is the main reason.
And what is this loss of forest doing to species?
Yeah, the deforestation is gradually diminishing the populations that exist of all the species. And in terms of biodiversity, there's probably 50,000 species in Haiti, and many of them occur only in Haiti. And so as you remove forest, you take away habitat. And your next speaker, Carrie, will be talking about the diminishing of populations. But in Haiti, it's right to the point where almost all the forest is gone, less than 1%. So it gets into the realm of actual species disappearing. In other words, the last individual dying. And that's what we examined in our study.
So you estimated that in a roughly 50-year period between the mid-80s and the year 2035, that somewhere between 66 to 83% of species will be lost in Haiti?
That's right. And if, by 2035, we estimate that all the primary forest will be gone, and that is the virgin forest, the forest that holds most of the species. You can have some species exist that are well adapted in a very open forest, but it's only about 10 to 20% or so of the total biodiversity. So the mass extinction is when all the primary forest is disappearing. And by 2035, we estimate through satellite imagery analysis that all of the forest will be gone, all the primary forest, and that means, by definition, about 80% or so of the species of everything will be gone.
Well, I want to zoom out of Haiti for a moment and look at the bigger global picture. And as you mentioned, our next guest will speak to some of this. But there have been, in the Earth's history, there have been five major mass extinctions. So most people may be familiar with the one that killed the dinosaurs, the asteroid. But what's going on right now globally? Are we in the midst of a sixth mass extinction event?
I think we are. And I think all the evidence really points to that. I mean, Haiti is one of the countries that is going to be the first, is in that direction. And I don't want to say it will happen, because I still have a lot of hope for Haiti in the sense that there is time to protect what still remains. And I'm involved in some of that activity as well. But it's symptomatic of the way the world is going, and like I said before, when you run out of the primary forest, you run out of the habitat, you don't have any more species left. So, yes, it is. It will be the sixth big extinction on Earth. There's no question.
And we welcome your questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Well, Dr. Hedges, I mean, what is this? You know, how alarming is this? Because your recent paper is, you know, a number, it's part of a broader body of research showing sharp declines in biodiversity and extinction. I mean, how worried should people be about what is happening to the natural world?
I think people should be very worried because besides the intrinsic value in our appreciation of biodiversity, there are things that can immediately affect people's lives. For example, in Haiti, when the forest is removed, the rainwater is no longer collected by the roots in the soil, and it just washes out and floods. Many people die every year in Haiti from floods caused by deforestation, and that's going to get worse. And also, the water is not retained in the springs and then the substructure of the soil and the rocks. And so the springs dry up and Haitians no longer have a consistent source of drinking water. So there's things like that that are happening. And I say Haiti, but it's, you know, it's all over the world that when the forests go, it's really going to impact people's lives in many ways.
And we have a listener email here. I don't know if you can speak to this, but they're asking, since Haiti shares the island with the Dominican Republic, do you know how the Dominican Republic is faring in terms of their forests?
Yeah, I work in the Dominican Republic the last 40 years or so, and it's in better shape. The forests are in better shape, but they have the same problem in that country as in Haiti. There are national parks, and the people of both countries really want to protect the species, but the protection is not working out in the parks, so the forests are disappearing. But the Dominican Republic has a bit more forest than in Haiti. But I should point out that this is a mountainous island, and many of the species in Haiti are not found in the Dominican Republic. So when they disappear in Haiti, they won't be saved in any place else in the world.
Okay, and let's go to the phones. We have a call from Donald in Enola. Donald, you're on the air.
Yes. I wondered if the good doctor is familiar with those solar cookers that are basically black pots and a reflective material like the aluminum foil encased in like a plastic. And whether that could be used in Cuba to cut down on the chopping of the wood.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've been watching the development of these various cooking devices over the years, and they are getting better, and I think that there is hope that they will be developed and distributed around Haiti and these other countries to relieve some of the pressure for deforestation, because that will provide more energy that won't come from the forest. But unfortunately, the clock is ticking, and it's so close to losing all of the forest in Haiti, and it's very hard to distribute equipment like that to 11 million people, that I think time is really running short for anything like that to work out. I hope it does, but I know what you're talking about, but it's getting pretty close. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Marie Cusick. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Marie Cusick, sitting in today for Scott Lamar. Wednesday, we will be learning about a new WITF health series that is investigating why individuals suffering from mental health illness often wait months to receive help. Also, the book Rethinking America from Empire to Republic takes a closer look into events leading up to the Revolutionary War. That's on Wednesday's Smart Talk. But right now, we're talking to Dr. Blair Hedges, a professor of biology at Temple University. He's the author of a new paper about the loss of biodiversity in Haiti and the implications of that for species extinction. But I'm going to bring another voice into the conversation right now. Carrie Cesario, she's Vice President for Forests at the World Wildlife Fund, is joining us from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Carrie's here to talk about their latest report called the Living Planet Report, which is a publication that's been around for 20 years now, using science and cutting-edge research to track the state of global biodiversity. So, Carrie, you published a Living Planet Index, which is, you know, I understand it's sort of like a stock market index for the diversity of animals worldwide. And you found that populations of vertebrates have declined by a staggering 60% since 1970. What do people need to understand about what's going on?
Yeah, that's right. Last week, we released the most recent edition of our Living Planet Report, which is a bit of a health check on the planet, and it's science-based. It pulls together a number of data sources, including the Living Planet Index. And I think that's where I think one of the most staggering statistics comes from, that says since in just over 40 years, we've seen a decline in wildlife populations. So that includes mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, amphibians. They've declined by an average of 60%. And picking up on Dr. Hedges' work, the tropics have been especially hard hit. So in South and Central America, they're even harder hit, with a dramatic decline of 89% across wildlife populations.
Wow, that's really shocking. Dr. Hedges, I guess I wanted to ask you too, I mean, what are organizations or people doing to try to reverse some of these trends?
There's a huge effort around the world by conservationists to stop what's going on in terms of deforestation, and I think Carrie actually could speak to that. Her organization is huge, and they've done wonderful things to slow this process. It'd be great if we could say we're stopping the process, but the best I think we can do at this point is to slow it down. Maybe Carrie has something more to say.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. It does feel a bit like we're in a managed decline situation. And I think we want to avoid being too much doom and gloom in that. I do think we have an unparalleled opportunity coming up to galvanize what have been a lot of well-intentioned and helpful efforts over the years that have made progress in conservation. But we have an opportunity in 2020 where global leaders will be coming together to review progress on our goals related to the Paris Climate Agreement, Sustainable Development Goals, and something called the Convention on Biological Diversity. And WWF is calling on people, leaders, business leaders, others to come together and basically respond in the way that we did to the climate threat by forging a new global deal, this time for people and nature. And the evidence we've seen is when people band together and forge regulation and policy, but also kind of align efforts, there's an opportunity to make change. I think a good example here in the United States has been the experience of the Endangered Species Act, which was enacted in 1973. some 99% of the species that have been listed under ESA have avoided extinction. So we have evidence if we rally together kind of across sectors and across across lines that we can make a difference, and we're banking on a larger ambition to get that done in 2020.
And we welcome your questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. And again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Carrie, you mentioned in this report that the current rates of species extinction are 100 to 1,000 times higher than the typical background rate of extinction. Could you kind of explain what that means?
Yes, so that's right. So the rate of decline that we're seeing is, as you said, 100 to 1,000 times the rate before human activity became a factor. And so that's the key, I think the key point here is that what we're seeing is driven by human activity, our demand for food, water, energy. And what that's doing is it's driving overfishing, unsustainable hunting, poaching, but, you know, picking up on Dr. Hedges' research, the largest single threat across wildlife populations is habitat loss and degradation. So basically we are, you know, with deforestation, we have this high rate where we're still seeing 27 soccer fields a minute lost, but we're also seeing similar losses of coral reef habitats, degradation of freshwater systems and that sort of thing. So, you know, one of the biggest drivers in that loss, one is driving for energy, as Dr. Hedges pointed to, but a big threat is the production of food. So how we produce and consume food needs to change. And WWF and many others are working with farmers, ranchers, and food companies to reduce the impact of how food is produced so that it requires less land, less water, that it's done in a way that results in less pollution. But we're also, you know, there's a role for people as citizens, consumers, eaters, to consider where and how their food is produced and to use both their voices and, you know, how they shop and eat to help make that change. But it's going to require, you know, change at the top. I mean, we definitely need federal and global action, but, you know, guided through all those systems.
I'll put this question to both of you. Maybe I'll start with you, Dr. Hedges. I mean, we spent the first part of the program talking about climate change. I think whatever people's feelings are about that, most people are certainly aware of climate change. Do either of you think people are as aware of what's going on with mass extinction and species loss and loss of biodiversity?
You know, that's a good question. I think climate change has gotten a higher billing, you know, in the media than the mass extinction problem. But they are, you know, they are related, and I think there needs to be more media attention for the loss of species around the world. And actually, in Haiti, the climate change, Haiti is supposed to be one of the top three or four countries in the world to be most affected by climate change. And the biggest problem is that it has almost no trees. And so so the extra heat that's added, it basically dries out the country, and it's even more severe. It's magnified, you could say, and that's going to happen elsewhere in the world.
Carrie, do you think people are generally familiar with what's going on here?
Not sufficiently. I mean, it's a success story, the level to which climate has risen on the agenda. I think nature is not just a nice to have, and I think people may not realize how much we depend on habitats and ecosystems and you know, these places that species call home for our daily existence. You know, clean air, clean water, food, energy, medicines, materials. In fact, it's only really in the loss of nature that we come to realize its importance. I think with the loss of, say, mangroves or other coastal habitats, and then we see, you know, increased devastation along coasts during storm events, or we're now seeing more research showing that as forests cut down, we see an increase in infectious disease rates, for example, with malaria. So it's often we don't know what we've got until we've lost it. And I think we need to find ways to elevate the role of nature in our discourse and sort of on get it on the agenda for business leaders as well as our political leaders.
And in your report, you put a dollar amount on what natural systems provide to humans, estimating that it's about $154 trillion per year. Do you think that that helps make the case a bit?
Yeah, I think the statistic is $125 trillion a year, but that's probably a very conservative estimate. It doesn't probably capture all of the benefits and services, but I think it points to the role of nature in powering our industries and our economies. I mean, so this isn't sort of a trade-off of business versus the environment. Really, it's intrinsic to our societies and sort of our ability to have productive economies. And that's actually why sometimes we're starting to see business leaders step up and make commitments because they're concerned about the underlying natural resource base that their businesses depend on. I think we still have a long way to go in terms of the scale of those commitments, but you are starting to see some realization of that natural capital component of our business.
And again, we welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. We're just talking about the economy and how much humans rely on nature. But Dr. Hedges, do you see this also as an ethical issue, given that, Haiti is one of the poorest countries in the world, and as you noted, it's sort of not well positioned to adapt and deal with climate change?
I guess you could say it's an ethical issue. One problem I see, because I've worked there for so many years, is that when aid comes to Haiti, it's often following a disaster, and it's very short-term aid. They bring big bags of rice and other foods, and they don't think about, the aid givers don't think about how the Haitians are going to cook it, because they need fuel, they need energy to cook all this food, and so the vicious circle starts again. In other words, there really hasn't been attention on the core problems that have caused all the suffering in Haiti, which is the degradation of the environment.
We have an email from a listener who asks, how are we to change the, quote, tribal conversation we're having and get the next generation of people to make choices that can save our way of life? Carrie, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. I mean, WWF has always been a bipartisan organization, nonpartisan, really looking to work on these issues that are important for all tribes, right? And so we need to continue that conversation, because at the end of the day, this is about people and their well-being, not just about kind of the underlying nature. And I think picking up on the previous comments too, there's this idea of thinking about biodiversity conservation as a sort of preventive medicine. Like, how do we, preventive measures instead of waiting till we have to put a Band-Aid on things, or where it's costing us more or it's harder to pull back and kind of reverse course with nature. And so I think there are allies on both sides, and it's actually one of those issues that could be a way to bridge and move forward in a positive way.
We have another email asking, does biotech have a role in the food production issue, and is changing the genetic makeup of crops affect, how does that affect some of these issues? Do either of you want to weigh in on that?
I'll let Carrie.
Dr. Hedges, well, I think at this point, I think we want all solutions on the table and to be considering, all the different ways and how different interventions are going to add up to delivering food in a way that is equitable, safe, good for the environment. We need to consider what will get us how far and all the impacts and trade-offs, I think, of different approaches. But certainly there's not going to be one silver bullet to producing a sustainable food system.
Do you think one of the, fundamental issues, perhaps, Carrie, you mentioned people sometimes see nature as like a nice thing to have, but it's just that people seeing themselves as sort of separate from nature, that that humans, there's the human environment and then there's the natural environment, and there's this sort of separation in our minds sometimes.
We certainly see that, and especially I think as populations across the globe become more concentrated in urban areas, that there's the danger of becoming ever more disconnected from nature. One of the more interesting streams of research I've seen as someone who works on forests is more published literature on the direct health benefits of just even spending a small amount of time in nature, sort of these ideas of forest bathing, and doctors prescribing that people need to get out in nature and kind of reconnect. So I think that's really interesting. I think people hear that and they kind of say, oh yeah, you know, like it makes sense for people. But we need to move towards a place where we're thinking about kind of these systems as all being interconnected, right? You have kind of your gray systems of roads and infrastructure and buildings, but then nature is very similar. It has green infrastructure, it has ways for people, you know, for wildlife and nature to kind of flow and get around. And I think, you know, redefining, you know, what the world is all these things together, that we start to think about how to be more integrated and kind of realize our dependence, I think, on both how we've impacted nature and then our dependence on those natural systems. It's like we're overpowering nature, even though we're powered by it. You know, we have, it's a duality of kind of depending on, but yet also being the species that can have the most negative impact on nature.
Okay, and we have a few minutes left, so we have time for one quick call. I'm going to go to Anne in York right now. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. This has been an interesting conversation. I would ask the panelists, please, to discuss what is happening to our insect pollinators, not just the honeybees, but the pollinators at large, which we depend on. There is so much early evidence that these populations are disappearing, too.
Either of you want to take that on? We have a couple minutes left.
Yeah, I'm happy to respond quickly to that. While the indices like the Living Planet Index were looking primarily at mammals and other vertebrates, we did include some research looking at the decline in pollinators writ large and the problem that poses in terms of disrupting food systems and other interconnected systems. So it is something we're seeing, that scientists are seeing. It's definitely concerning and gets back to that issue of habitat protection, among other things. Obviously, there are direct impacts on those populations as well, but certainly some of the same interventions for other wildlife or other animals will be relevant for insect populations.
Yeah, and Dr. Hedges, I know I've seen some other papers recently too about this staggering loss of insect life. And are you finding that? And I'm sure that's part of what you were looking at in Haiti as well, right?
Well, you're right. I mean, that's we're kind of looking at it through a proxy of vertebrates, because the insects are so poorly known that we can only assume that there's a proportional loss in insects as there is in vertebrates. But you're right. What we do know of the insects on that island, Hispaniola, it has tremendous diversity and endemism, that is, species occurring nowhere else in the world except on these mountaintops in Haiti. So if we, we protect these last forests, we're going to protect everything, the vertebrates, the insects, the microbes, all of the biodiversity. So that's, that's our standpoint, is saving it all.
All right, we have about a minute left. Carrie, is there any final thought you want to leave folks with here today?
Yeah, I always like to go out on a positive note, which is to say that, it's not too late to course correct when given a chance. Life is resilient. It bounces back. I think some experiences we're seeing with other species, such as giant panda, mountain gorillas, where we've seen increases in those populations, gives us hope. But we do need to take action. We have a window in which to do that. And just calling on everyday citizens to consider that as they vote, as they go out and shop, as they send their messages to leaders. So that's where I would leave things.
And Dr. Hedges?
Yeah, real quickly, on a positive note, I think the Haitian people really want to save the biodiversity, all those people I've talked to down there, and there are enough organizations going on, like one I'm involved in, Haiti Trust, Haiti National Trust, that if we give more support, I think we can make a difference and maybe stop the trajectory.
All right, I want to say thank you to both of you. Dr. Blair Hedges, a professor of biology at Temple University, and Carrie Cesario, vice president for forests at the World Wildlife Fund. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.